very often the innovation that I think that changes businesses lies at the edges. So go and speak to the guys and girls who are at the edge. You know, the answers will often be there.
So we've been talking to a lot of leaders across the workplace who think about every day, how do we create a high-performing workforce? Talking to people who are policy leaders, talking to subject matter experts, have written great books on the future of work. We've talked to learning scientists, thinking about how learning works. And it just is like a natural extension that the next person we're going to talk to are experts on pirates. Like, why not? I'm a big pirate fan, and one of my favorite books off my shelf is written by Sam Conniff. He's an entrepreneur and author of Be More Pirate, How to Take on the World and Win. Listen, I see a lot of parallels today and a lot we can learn from when we think about the future of work. If we just look to the pirates of their day to understand what kind of code they lived by, to understand how they worked as a team in a unit, but also to think about the mission and the vision that pirates were able to create aboard their ships, also a pretty wild amount of diversity ahead of its time happened on pirate ships. So with that, I want to talk to Sam about his book. Sam is a British entrepreneur and author. He's the co-founder of Liberty, an award-winning social enterprise and youth-led creative network that invites refugees, excluded children, and other marginalized groups to lend their ideas to socially focused marketing campaigns. He's the co-founder of Digify Africa, a nonprofit providing digital skill development in Africa. This book, Be More Pirate, How to Take on the World and Win, was inspired by the golden age of pirates, recasted legends like Henry Morgan and Blackbeard as inspiration for 21st century entrepreneurs working in the 21st century, recasting them as agents of change, leadership, and social innovation. So let's see what Sam Conniff and pirates have to say about the future of work. Let's bring it in.
So Sam, why'd you write Be More Pirate?
Because I was very annoyed and growing increasingly bored with the conversation in work about change. It struck me, having done God knows how many hundred away days to talk about change, people stick post-it notes on the walls, call the same thing a different name, talk about innovation, and then go back to work and do exactly the same thing, putting all their ideas into an email or two where everybody knows good ideas are sent to die. So eventually I decided that perhaps, maybe, rather than it be an irresponsible thing to do to break the rules, it might just be the responsible thing left to do to bring about any goddamn change. And I was trying to find some good examples of people who are great at breaking rules and who is better than the pirates at not just breaking rules, but making new rules.
Why pirates?
I've been an entrepreneur all my life, reluctantly the first half and enjoyably the second half. And I would often use pirates as a metaphor, as a kind of euphemism for get up and go zeal. And I'm sure lots of owner managers, lots of people who've done their own thing will have some kind of story they say, you know, or some kind of proxy, you know, where we're going to be, you know, we've got to get up and go about it, whatever it is. Mine has always been pirates. And as I was leaving my biggest company, my longest running company, it had been a big part of my ego and my identity for many, many years. And I knew it was time to go. And I knew I needed a vehicle, right, for leaving that thing behind. And so I thought I'd write a book. I got a chip on my shoulder. I didn't go to school. I didn't go to college, what you would call school. Dyslexic and just always wanted to write books, right? So I started writing the most boring book on earth. I started writing the book that I thought was the grown-up book, having run my own businesses since I was a teenager. And I was leaving this place as I turned 40, and it was like, right, okay, I'm going to do something grown up now. Because running my own business had always seen, I was always the imposter. It was always too much fun, even when it wasn't fun. And so I thought, this is me, right? I've got to do something grown up. So I started to write a book about business, about my perspectives on business. And it was the most boring book I think has ever been written. I got 20,000 words in. I'm not a business guru or a business leader. Like my main interest throughout my life has always been in entrepreneurs, in entrepreneurial circles. And I read it to some colleagues and some guys I mentor and coach in entrepreneurial spaces. And they were like, what the F has happened to you, man? Where's all the, You know, where's all the stories? Where are all the adventures you've had? Where's all the near-death experiences? Sam, where are all the pirates? And I've got, you know, I've got loads of stories, lots of experiences and loads of, you know, lucky takes on things. And I went back to my desk and thought, yeah, where are all the pirates? And then I thought, why do I always talk about pirates? And then I thought, you know what? I probably need to actually justify that. Like people who call out their heroes or, you know, we cite, you know, people reference everyone from Gandhi to whatever. Like who really knows the full deep story? And so because I was having increasing amounts of time on my hands as I was exiting the firm, I went to the British Library and I started to read about the true history of pirates. And it was like getting a slap in the face, right? You spend your whole life thinking it's Jack Sparrow and Captain Hook. And then you discover that the true history of pirates is not what you ever knew. And it couldn't have been a better metaphor for the thing you wanted to learn. And honestly, then for the next like 9 months that I wrote the book, I was in a race against all the people in my head who must have made the same realization that I have, who'd stepped on this bit of history that was otherwise unearthed. And I thought, surely someone else is going to draw this analogy. But luckily, I made it to the finish line first.
I mean, I got the book here and it's marked up pretty good, to be honest with you. So that's a good thing. And what do you have a favorite pirate? I guess you have after going through everything you went through, is there a favorite pirate story you have?
Yeah, Anne Bonny. She's got to be the one. She's just incredible. This, you know, very relatively, you know, mixed. It's the life everyone, you know, kind of has. She almost is born in privilege, but she squanders the privilege. Her dad has an affair with the maid. You know, it's just a brilliant story of like the English class system at the time, what's totally unacceptable, you know, shunned for having an affair with the maid, or what's it all about? And my guess is that she has, and because pirate history has to be interpreted, right? She has a realization of how unfair the world is. And with this, she has a fight, a stepmother, she takes a knife to her stepmom, her dad's in love with a maid, she wants to champion love, she ends up running away, jumps on a ship, finds a way to East Coast America, and then she's just a tearaway, right? She's an absolute hooligan, but this stunning redhead Irish woman. And then Captain Calico Jack Rackham, one of the most famous pirates, is coming down the eastern seaboard, causing mayhem. And he was like a real prince, and all the stories about him are him stealing clothes to get dressed up in his fineries, and a remarkable guy. And actually, allegedly, quite the entrepreneur, because he's one of the pirates that made the Skull and Crossbones their brand, and actually understood the idea that this brand stood for something and knew that it had a message. And they partnered up. And they became this, they were like the Jay-Z and Beyonce of the pirate world, like, you know, unstoppable force. And she would lead from the front. There's these stories of them under attack and she's there, two pistols on the deck whilst everyone else is diving beneath. And she just continues on. And then her story ends in this amazing, finally, Jack gets captured. There's this great legendary line that she tells him he'll die like a dog because he couldn't fight like a man, and she's still fighting. And then she escapes prison at the very end of it. And no one knows whatever happened to her. It's like, it is an utter movie. And if you throw in the bit with Mary Read, who's the other famous female pirate, and they both had to cross dress. Did they have an affair? Like, it's just phenomenal. It's movie time.
I think that, you know, one of the things in the book that stood out to me is, you know, I picked it up, you know, having a bunch of pirate books on my shelf. And then I obviously saw the book grabbed me, talking about as a leader or an entrepreneur, a human, just that kind of caught me as I started to process the book. And one of the things that stuck out to me is this, that I never thought about this way, was how pirates were, they weren't, I mean, the position that a lot of the story, you know, a lot of the tales were expanded on, or in many ways they had a marketing story or a brand story. Yeah. That was, you know, I think, was it one of the pirates mentioned had never actually been on record murdering, or mm-hmm. there was no violence on record directly from him. Yep. And yet they were really good storytellers.
Absolutely. I mean, the story, I think, is really the power of it, and the story is the power of any business. I mean, we know the essential ingredients are the people, the money, the culture, and the customers. But it's the stories that we tell determine as much as anything our potential for growth, the people that follow us. And I think really importantly, talking to people who are part of their business, have a stake in their business, you know, whether that's financial or emotional, the story that you tell yourself about your business is a story of you, right? You know, every story is an externalization of our identity. And what I've found, having gone through a couple of businesses, is the story you tell yourself about the businesses you've had, the success and the failures, becomes a very important part of who you are. And certainly it's the power of success. Like there's their stories. Anne Bonny's story, picking back on her, she was an amazing picture of her, you know, with one her chest semi-bare, her hand raised with a flag, the other with a sword. It's the exact same image of Lady Liberty leading the brave, which is the famous picture of Les Miserables, right? And the book, which had her etching in, it was called A Famous General History of Pirates, was found in the studio in Paris of the painter of that iconic image, which becomes Les Miserables. And then the image of Les Miserables is the most famous relationship that has is, of course, with the Statue of Liberty. Now, that is not causal history, but, you know, there's more than a correlation line there. And it's about the stories. And it's known that Anne Bonny's story was told amongst the proto-feminist literary circles of London, you know, that led to the suffragettes movement. And exactly the same. Yeah, Blackbeard is the guy you're citing. Like, there couldn't be a more famous pirate than Blackbeard. No record of him killing anyone whatsoever until the day of his death. And the what makes it interesting is you go the other way with Blackbeard. He's so famous because he really invents this icon. So the story goes, he was so committed to the pirate brand, he would set light to sulfurous fuses that he'd tie into the ends of his beard. So when he appeared on the horizon or climbing aboard your ship, you know, it was like absolute hell bearing down on you. And what better representation is that of someone taking a brand idea, living it to the full, and it then driving the bottom line? Because if you don't have to kill anyone, you know, there's a massive profit increase. You know, you're receiving less damage, you're giving less damage, and there they were. They are, and this is the big mistake. Pirates exist on the long arc of certainly the English working class, but the English working class have a role to play in the long fight for equality and rights. And you can trace the dynamics of that through the trade union movement, the civil rights movement, to suffragettes, and fight for equality and rights that's still ongoing and hasn't been completed. And the what perpetuates them isn't the fact that they were pirates, you know, that's like the Levellers or the Chartists or any one of those important chapters, but they told such a damn good story. Like, that was their real power, that people followed them. And we're still, to this day, they're a multi-million pound franchise, right? There's something about the romance, the idea, the individual against the enemy. And who doesn't want to sometimes just pull out you know, their cutlass and swashbuckle their way through the red tape bureaucracy and just general nonsense of life? Like, of course it stays with us. And that, my argument is, it was intentional. They designed that. It was theater.
So today we have Great Resignation. You have Quiet Quitting. You have Boss Loss. I've heard Quiet Hiring is one now. And I even heard, I think I heard two in 1 week. I heard Quiet Hiring and I heard Rage Applying this week, which is the next one. They're just coming out all over the place. And I got to ask you, right? I mean, how are you, because you think about this, you work with brands, you work with leaders. The stories around work right now, it feels like more Royal Navy than pirate.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, how do you connect what's happening in the workforce right now from organizations who maybe built themselves up as pirates, who are kind of almost going from, they're evolving the other way?
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. And we can name check a few, you know, the big kind of pirate brands. You know, Steve Jobs famously called on the pirate brand repeatedly. They flew an Apple, they flew a skull and crossbones over Apple HQ on the day that he died. I don't think there's anyone in the world that could say that Apple behaves like a pirate organization now. They certainly set the tone, right? And they're way ahead, but by God, does it feel like a pirate? And so is the Pirate Association therefore the upstart, the challenger, the new story, the story that drives innovation perhaps? And is it necessary and kind of noble for the larger organizations to kind of fall into these traps of quiet quitting? And I think the story is bigger than all of that. And I think those kind of slightly trite titles will be misleading always. My guess is that in a time of like really tough change, change that's outside the experience set of most leaders, we as humans struggle with that, right? So we look for narratives. There's a really great study that in times of uncertainty, human beings will choose an electric shock over the possibility of an electric shock. Like, we really hate uncertainty and change so badly, we'd prefer the pain. And you see it, right? In really times of great upheaval, people will go through extremes of politics. We you know, the backward-looking narratives of build back better and new normal, that feels like something I can believe in, right? Rather than take the moment of this profound fragility to do something differently. And what I've been looking at, because I think People Power got a lot of people to the place of change. But then when you actually make the change, it becomes quite scary. And being a pirate allows you to do that. And as I look back on the success of being a pirate, I think it's a bit like a fancy dress party. Fancy dress parties are like, they're like 15% more fun than any other party because you get to pretend you're someone else, right? You do a few things that you wouldn't normally do. And that's really what I heard back from people who've been really successful being a pirate. They just took that bit extra risk because they were being cavalier. They were calling themselves pirate and it was like a mask for the time. But in really profound change, I met people who didn't know how to navigate. And so one of the things I've been studying as I look increasingly at leaders peddling these backward-looking narratives or observers using these trite and really unhelpful terms, I've been looking for leaders who have excelled in uncertainty. And it's interesting because it was something you said about people, the workforce that you walk by. The more I looked at our own political leaders on the daily news over the last 2 years and some of the narratives coming out of lots of business and it peddling this false certainty or backward looking stuff, I started interviewing people who'd gone through the experience of being refugees and then started their own business. People who'd been on the streets and started their own charity. People who'd run gangs and are now running business. People who'd been prisoners of war. I got this real idea of uncertainty experts. And it follows on in my head from the work I did with pirates, because I'm always interested in innovation from the edges. But we overlook and misunderstand millions of people every day who are experts in uncertainty. In the UK, there's 12 million people in poverty, which is 20% of the population. There's 1.2 million homeless. There's 4 million single parents. There's 216,000 young adults in gangs. I mean, compared to your populations, this is crazy figures. But every single one of them masters uncertainty every single day. It takes a fucking hell of a lot of tenacity and wisdom and knowledge and experience and balls to get from the beginning of the day to the end of the day, depending on your circumstances in some of those areas, right? They nail uncertainty and they don't depend on backward-looking ideas. There's deep innovation happening. So my interest in pirates has led me to a rather interesting place in uncertainty, which is a long way of saying I generally tend to ignore those explanations or those titles because I think the weakness in the titling that's being given is a demonstration that the observer doesn't understand what's going on beneath the situation.
I had a call with an HR person the other day we were in conversation about how they advance their software stack for workforce development. And by the way, on their website, one of their core values is innovation.
Right.
And they ended up choosing a platform that it was like a desktop product that only a certain amount of people could access. And they're a restaurant brand. So heavy frontline, heavy, low wage workforce that are, definitely have a smartphone in their pocket, but are moving quick. And her reaction was, yeah, so what? We'll work with what we got.
Yep.
And it's this feeling, like you mentioned, there's this feeling of those that get paid the least often pay the most in certain societies.
Yeah.
What story do we need to tell to get people to see those workers for more than just expendable or the first ones to go when it's time to, lay off or cut back?
In my experience, the best answers to the problems organizations face come from the people who are closest to those problems. on a day. So, you know, we're talking about infrastructure or logistics. You know, we're talking about the kind of efficiencies that external consultants or whatever will come in and be able to avoid. If you look at it from a spreadsheet, you'll often find numerical answers. But if you end up speaking to, I don't know, the last time I did this exercise, it was a guy called Hans. And Hans actually sat next to the problem. And he'd sat next to the fucking problem, excuse my language, he'd sat next to the exact problem for the last 3 years. And Hans had never told anyone what the answer was because he didn't believe anyone was going to listen. In the back of his mind, he thought if they did listen, they'd probably steal his idea. And so he continued his job inefficiently, well aware of it. At the pub afterwards with a drink, maybe he'd talk about his answer and idea. You know, there's an ideas box, you know, not too many meters away from Hans's daily existence. And probably, and I don't know the instance in this, what was paid to the consultants who came in to find innovation that didn't get to the actual problem, Hans watched them come and go. And I don't, you know, that is a genuine story. I won't name the company because they were clients of mine and they did do good work and they did let Hans put the innovation in place. But it's a true story and it's not an unusual story, but it's a kind of caricature of where I think often happens. If you want to know what's really going on, the companies I really love working with, there's a firm called Nando's in the UK. I really enjoy working with them. They're doing really well, expanding, a South African firm. And you cannot get a management position unless you do the shop floor. You just can't, they won't let you do it. And then on a regular basis, you're back in the kitchen. And, you know, this is my belief. My first ever roles were all frontline. And McDonald's, you know, reception, front of house, a bar back. And through my business career, and I never actually fully executed it, but my belief was if you want to get a senior role here, you got to go and do a week on the front, whether we're, you know, that's a bar or the door. I've been a doorman, you know, and it is in those experiences that you change your perspective. And it's far too easy to forget that if you haven't had it. So I think the answer is huge. And the innovation that we need, very often the innovation that I think that changes businesses lies at the edges. So go and speak to the guys and girls who are at the edge. You know, the answers will often be there. If they'll tell you the truth.
I think I even read in your bio that, you know, you worked in the restaurant industry coming up a little bit. You had to stop. I had read Devil in the Kitchen a bunch of months ago with Marco Pierre White. Yeah. What was it like to be in an environment like that?
I was there very, very shortly. I spent a year and a half in kitchens. But they were very colloquial and local. I had a kind of love affair with what I thought was learning to chef with this insane family restaurant. The stories there were just unbelievable. She was she'd once been Miss Barbados, the woman who ran it, and she never let you forget it. Like 20 years before, but never let you forget it. She was on her third husband. He used to drink beer out of teacups all day long. It was just the best ever place. And so I kind of mistakenly fell in love with kitchens and what you can do. And I ended up running the kitchen, certainly designing menus, cooking. It was great. And then I thought, right, it's my time to leave. I've got to go to the big city, you know, and this was just in South London. So I thought I can do it. I can be it. And at the time I was running nightclubs and events. So it was a great life. It was a lot of fun. And I thought, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go and be a proper chef. And I got a job in a Marco Pierre White restaurant, into that kitchen, completely different world. You know, you're just at the beginning, you just do prep. You just make everyone else's food. And I just couldn't handle it, man. I could not handle it. And this is 20 years ago. So the misogyny, like it was out and out outrageous. And the misogyny, racism, prejudice, the humor, let's call it that, if we're trying to be generous. But it was a tough environment. And I'm I reckon I'm fairly thick-skinned. I've had my near-death experiences more than most, but this was just like wow. And then this huge break between the serves, and that's just the amount of booze that would get drunk between the serves, and then the amount of booze that would get drunk after the service. I mean, it was a hardcore existence. And actually, what I loved, what I've always loved, is making things. I love an empty plate and a half-stuck fridge, and I like the freedom to do that. And I could not. The complete honest truth is, I couldn't hack being on a supply line, just mm-hmm. making the carrots today. And under that pressure, man, I didn't last more than did about 2 weeks and one day. So just under the amount of time I did at McDonald's.
And a lot of people listening are in the hospitality sector and they're running kitchens or front of house or trying to scale businesses. You mentioned working with Nando's.
Yeah.
I guess what's one piece of advice maybe you have or maybe one pirate thing that a business leader in that world should employ today? Again, given the climate, given the wage circumstance, given the economic moment, given where work is going, given how food is almost, you know, now you got Top Chef season 400 coming out, you know, so in London, by the way, right? What's a piece of advice you have for a business leader that you think they should incorporate?
So that stayed with me, that experience, and that difference between in a kitchen environment where I felt like I had, you know, agency and capacity and control, and then being in an environment where that was taken away from me. And I just didn't feel like I had any say in what was going on. And it stayed with me profoundly. And so whilst I didn't meet the metal on that one, I certainly didn't lose any respect for the people I work with. I found it, if anything. And I've always had that. And it's left me with a skill that's probably the thing that I'm most proud of. I would count myself fairly multilingual in business world. And so every single business I've had that I've scaled, or every bit of consultancy that I've done, it's been that interplay. It's actually the story that we just told. And it was how do you take ideas at the edges and bring them back to the boardroom where decisions are made? And how do you celebrate that so that the people on the front line, on the shop floor, on the door, know that their ideas are being listened to? Because like I said earlier on, the problems in a nightclub with capacity and getting people in efficiently and making money, you know, the girl on the door or the guy is the security with it, they've worked it out months ago. And then you're there trying to work it out with a spreadsheet a while back. And that process of getting ideas from the front line whilst they're being knotted through, that's where, well, you know, that's what play is, you know, is the exploration of how we often come up with our best thoughts. And then there we are, struggling, stressed. We haven't met the targets. You know, we're kind of always, there's a lag with the problem. The problem's been bubbling along. The spreadsheet tells us it's too much. And then we come up with a solution that's based on a spreadsheet, which means it will be a cognitive-based decision. But the emotions, the nuance, the instinct, the intuition, everything that makes the best of human judgments is taking place at the epicenter of the problem. So I cited Nando's, and I didn't know this question was coming out of genuine respect. And I know how much innovation comes because time and again, they're back on the shop floor. So I think where there's capacity to, and I've done it, when I was CEO of a 150-person multi-million-pound business, I did deliveries, I did warehousing, the packing, the unpacking, I catered for the entire team, I did two nights as a security guard. I regularly put myself back into that environment. And it wasn't just to kind of show that I'm one of the guys, it was to have the trust so that the guys and the girls, absolutely, would trust me to bring their ideas to me. Because I think that's the most difficult thing. You can go down on the shop floor, and I've done this with lots of CEOs, taking them down to the factory floor, and they won't be told the truth. You know, it takes a while to get that trust. So it's not just the exercise of trading places. It's doing so in a way that the communication channel is there. So the ideas that you're missing that only show up on a spreadsheet down the line or when money's being lost, and they're going through some smart guy's head who's watching this problem day in, day out. So that's the advice. Try and build that channel of communication and trust.
Love it. Sam, I appreciate your time. Last question for you. You know, we're talking about future of work. What's your hope for the future of work?
It probably follows on this idea, right? There's a guy I know, and he started a business called Sideways Six. And it's not a business I'm involved with. This is no plug, but it suggests where this can go. And Sideways Six is like the old ideas box, but he's digitized the ideas box and that trust network. And in the organizations that run it, it comes up, it's like on your, you know, you can have it as an app if you're in a kitchen, you can have it at a workstation. And because it's there and it's ever present, and because it's slightly anonymized and it's listened to, you have this really amazing moment when new initiatives are started, you know, changes are made in, you know, something that's tiny to the execs, but makes the biggest difference in the world, like the day of payment, the hour and time of payment, or the method in which it's paid. And so I see this future. I see the future of work as, you know, there's already a lot of thinking about the kind of hierarchies of it, but I'm really into this idea of splitting of the responsibilities and the decision making. I think the sense of agency that I have a say and a role in this thing that I'm listened to, it's easily said, and I think it's bandied about. But as the kind of war for talent comes along, as you know, in the UK, there's been a huge shift in the kind of workforce we're talking about because of Brexit. So there's a huge challenge getting the kind of skill, charisma, just knowledge, language that's needed on the shop floor or front of house. And when that happens, that sense of belief that I am a part of the function here, and, you know, it's a cliche, it can be oversaid, but it's all important, but it has to be proven. And so I get really excited when I see, and I one of my most out there predictions is not just that kind of trading places moment I was talking about, but would be like real long-term functional job splits. So, you know, it excites me when I see organizations who have lay people on the board. So they'll have, when I worked in youth and youth development for young people, you'd make sure there was always young people on the board. If it's a business that's, you know, majority of its revenue comes through front of house or front of shop, having those guys on the board, like genuinely finding ways for this decision-making to take place, whether it's CEOs and C-suite spending real time on the floor, whether it's techniques like Sideways 6, which digitizes it, or this kind of split role future that I think would be really, really exciting way of seeing it. But ultimately, yeah, it's going to be about sharing of decision-making, sharing of agency, and whether we mean it financially or emotionally, some degree of ownership too.
Sam, I love it. You got to end on a pirate quote. You got a pirate quote?
Yeah. My favorite line or thought that comes out of that book is that whole one about the biggest mistake that we can make is thinking the way things are is the way they have to be. And whenever you hear someone say, in response to your question, why don't we try something new? You know, why don't we do something different? When they say, we've tried that, it didn't work. That, my pirate friends, is the direction in which to go. Let that rail against you as we stand for doing something differently. Because, you know, I no longer think, from writing that book and seeing the change, that breaking rules is the risky thing to do. With the right people around you and the right intention, it's become the responsible thing to do. It is upon us to rewrite the rules of business as they currently stand.
Sam, appreciate you, brother. Great to meet you.
Really, really nice meeting you, man. Please stay in touch, Sam.
You know, I think one of the biggest takeaways from the discussion with Sam, you know, is this notion about the pirate metaphor around how organizations go through a pirate stage, maybe early on, and then something happens. You know, he talked about Steve Jobs and Apple. They flew the pirate flag under him when he passed. They threw it back up again. But, you know, to Sam's point, not many people would consider Apple pirates anymore. I also liked Sam's point as he was talking about managers saying that putting yourself back in the environment is crucial. Not just because you need to do it as a leader, but because it creates an environment where your people trust you. You know, we live in a world today where too often organizations have leaders who point at their people instead of fighting in the trenches every day with them. And I think, again, this is another point around pirate culture that we can learn a lot about today on how we create teams that are sailing in the right direction together. One final thing I took away from Sam's comments is he said that the biggest mistake we can make is thinking the way things are is the way they have to be. And it's upon us to rewrite the rules of business. If what we're really talking about in this podcast is the future of work, then that's a very powerful thought to consider. Because pirates woke up every day and on a mission together, set out to change something. And I think as leaders, if you're ever in a position where you're adopting the perspective that you can't change something and it's just the way it is the way it's always been done, that's probably the day that you stop being a leader. And maybe you gotta walk a plank, Jaime. I don't know.
Not the plank.
You know, Sam said he wrote this book because he was working with a lot of startups and he realized that the pirate metaphor, it applied well to startups, but it also applied to a lot of others. And the conversation just makes me think how much better our workplace and workforce may be if the pirates rose up just a little bit more. So if you haven't already, head on over to your local bookstore and pick up Be More Pirate or How to Take on the World and Win. Also, you can look up Sam Cunniff online. Ton of great videos, ton of great resources. And don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not going to want to miss. Now, back to work.